He hoped Jakes would be a long time arranging Sonia's release so that he could sit on the bench a little while longer. He thought of Billy. He did not want the boy to miss him at breakfast. Perhaps I'll stay awake until morning, then take him to school, then go home and sleep, he thought. What would Billy's life be like under the Nazis? They would teach him to despise the Arabs. His present teachers were no great admirers of African culture, but at least Van Damme could do a little to make his son realize that people who were different were not necessarily stupid. What would happen in the Nazi classroom when he put up his hand and said, "Please, sir, my dad says a dumb Englishman is no smarter than a dumb Arab"? He thought of Elena. Now she was a kept woman, but at least she could choose her lovers, and if she didn't like what they wanted to do in bed, she could kick them out. In the brothel of a concentration camp, she would have no such choice. He shuddered. Yes, we're not very admirable, especially in our colonies. But the Nazis are worse, whether the Egyptians know it or not. It is worth fighting. In England, decency is making slow progress. In Germany, it's taking a big step backward. Think about the people you love, and the issues become clearer. Draw strength from that. Stay awake a little longer. Stand up. He stood up. Jakes came back. Van Damme said, "She's an Anglophobe." "I beg your pardon, sir?" "Sonia. She hates the British. I don't believe Wolf was a casual pickup. Let's go." They walked out of the building together. Outside, it was still dark. Jake said, "Sir, you're very tired." "Yes, I'm very tired. But I'm still thinking straight, Jakes. Take me to the main police station." "Sir." They pulled away. Van Damme handed his cigarette case and lighter to Jakes, who drove one-handed while he lit Van Damme's cigarette. Van Damme had trouble sucking. He could hold the cigarette between his lips and breathe the smoke, but he could not draw on it hard enough to light it. Jakes handed him the lit cigarette. Van Damme thought, "I'd like a martini to go with it." Jake stopped the car outside police headquarters. Van Damme said, "We want the chief of detectives, whatever they call him." "I shouldn't think he'll be there at this hour." "No, get his address. We'll wake him up." Jakes went into the building. Van Damme stared ahead through the windshield. Dawn was on its way. The stars had winked out, and now the sky was gray rather than black. There were a few people about. He saw a man leading two donkeys loaded with vegetables, presumably going to market. The muezzins had not yet called the first prayer of the day.
This ends side one of cassette five. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
Jakes came back. "Gezira," he said, as he put the car in gear and let in the clutch. Van Damme thought about Jakes. Someone had told Van Damme that Jakes had a terrific sense of humor. Van Damme had always found him pleasant and cheerful, but he had never seen any evidence of actual humor. "Am I such a tyrant," Van Damme thought, "that my staff are terrified of cracking a joke in my presence? Nobody makes me laugh," he thought. "Except Elena."
"You never tell me jokes, Jakes."
"Sir?"
"They say you have a terrific sense of humor, but you never tell me jokes."
"No, sir."
"Would you care to be candid for a moment and tell me why?"
There was a pause, then Jakes said,
"You don't invite familiarity, sir."
Van Damme nodded. How would they know how much he'd like to throw back his head and roar with laughter? He said,
"Very tactfully put, Jakes. The subject is closed."
The wolf business is getting to me, he thought. I wonder whether perhaps I've never really been any good at my job. And then I wonder if I'm any good for anything at all. And my face hurts.
They crossed the bridge to the island. The sky turned from slate gray to pearl. Jake said,
I'd like to say, sir, that if you'll pardon me, you're far and away the best superior officer I've ever had.
Oh. Van Damme was quite taken aback. Good Lord. Well, thank you, Jakes, thank you.
Not at all, sir. We're there.
He stopped the car outside a small, pretty, single-story house with a well-watered garden. Van Damme guessed that the chief of detectives was doing well enough out of his bribes, but not too well. A cautious man, perhaps. It was a good sign. They walked up the path and hammered on the door. After a couple of minutes, a head looked out of a window and spoke in Arabic. Jakes put on his sergeant major's voice.
Military intelligence! Open up the bloody door!
A minute later, a small, handsome Arab opened up, still belting his trousers. He said in English,
What's going on?
Van Damme took charge. An emergency. Let us in, will you?
Of course.
The detective stood aside and they entered. He led them into a small living room.
What has happened?
He seemed frightened, and Van Damme thought, Who wouldn't be? The knock on the door in the middle of the night? Van Damme said, There's nothing to panic about, but we want you to set up a surveillance, and we need it right away.
Of course. Please, sit down.
The detective found a notebook and pencil.
Who is the subject?
Sonia El Aram.
The dancer?
Yes. I want you to put a 24-hour watch on her home, which is a houseboat called Jihan in Zamalek. As the detective wrote down the details, Van Damme wished he did not have to use the Egyptian police for this work. However, he had no choice. It was impossible in an African country to use conspicuous, white-skinned, English-speaking people for surveillance. The detective said,
And what is the nature of the crime?
I'm not telling you, Van Damme thought. He said,
We think she may be an associate of whoever is passing counterfeit sterling in Cairo. So you want to know who comes and goes, whether they carry anything, whether meetings are held aboard the boat?
Yes. And there is a particular man that we're interested in. He is Alex Wolfe, the man suspected of the Assiut knife murder. You should have his description already.
Of course. Daily reports?
Yes. Except that if Wolfe is seen, I want to know immediately. You can reach Captain Jakes or me at GHQ during the day. Give him our home phone numbers, Jakes.
I know these houseboats, the detective said. The towpath is a popular evening walk, I think, especially for sweethearts.
Jake said,
That's right.
Van Damme raised an eyebrow at Jake's. The detective went on.
A good place, perhaps, for a beggar to sit. Nobody ever sees a beggar. At night, well, there are no bushes. Also popular with sweethearts.
Van Damme said, Is that right, Jake's?
I wouldn't know, sir.
He realized he was being ribbed, and he smiled. He gave the detective a piece of paper with the phone numbers written on it. A little boy in pajamas walked into the room, rubbing his eyes. He was about 5 or 6 years old. He looked around the room sleepily, then went to the detective.
My son, the detective said proudly.
I think we can leave you now, Van Damme said. Unless you want us to drop you in the city?
No, thank you. I have a car, and I should like to put on my jacket and tie and comb my hair.
Very well, but make it fast. Van Damme stood up. Suddenly he could not see straight. It was as if his eyelids were closing involuntarily. Yet he knew he had his eyes wide open. He felt himself losing his balance. Then Jakes was beside him, holding his arm.
All right, sir?
His vision returned slowly. All right now, he said.
You've had a nasty injury, the detective said sympathetically.
They went to the door. The detective said,
Gentlemen, be assured that I will handle this surveillance personally. They won't get a mouse aboard that houseboat without your knowing it.
He was still holding the little boy, and now he shifted him onto his left hip and held out his right hand. Goodbye, Van Damme said. He shook hands. By the way, I'm Major Van Damme. The detective gave a little bow.
Superintendent Kamel. At your service, sir.
Chapter 14. Sonia brooded. She had half expected Wolf to be at the houseboat when she returned toward dawn, but she had found the place cold and empty. She was not sure how she felt about that.
At first, when they had arrested her, she had felt nothing but rage toward Wolf for running away and leaving her at the mercy of the British thugs. Being alone, being a woman, and being an accomplice of sorts in Wolf's spying, she was terrified of what they might do to her. She thought Wolf should have stayed to look after her. Then she had realized that that would not have been smart. By abandoning her, he had diverted suspicion away from her. It was hard to take, but it was for the best. Sitting alone in the bare little room at GHQ, she had turned her anger away from Wolf and toward the British. She had defied them, and they had backed down. At the time, she had not been sure that the man who interrogated her had been Major Van Damme. But later, when she was being released, the clerk had let the name slip. The confirmation had delighted her. She smiled again when she thought of the grotesque bandage on Van Damme's face. Wolf must have cut him with a knife. He should have killed him. But all the same, what a night. What a glorious night. She wondered where Wolf was now. He would have gone to ground somewhere in the city. He would emerge when he thought the coast was clear. There was nothing she could do. She would have liked him here, though, to share the triumph. She put on her nightdress. She knew she ought to go to bed, but she did not feel sleepy. Perhaps a drink would help. She found a bottle of Scotch whiskey, poured some into a glass, and added water. As she was tasting it, she heard footsteps on the gangplank. Without thinking, she called, "Ahmed?" Then she realized the step was not his. It was too light and quick. She stood at the foot of the ladder in her nightdress, with the drink in her hand. The hatch was lifted, and an Arab face looked in. "Sonia?" "Yes?" "You were expecting someone else, I think." The man climbed down the ladder. Sonia watched him, thinking, what now? He stepped off the ladder and stood in front of her. He was a small man with a handsome face and quick, neat movements. He wore European clothes, dark trousers, polished black shoes, and a short-sleeved white shirt. "I am Detective Superintendent Kamel, and I am honored to meet you." He held out his hand. Sonia turned away, walked across to the divan, and sat down. She thought she had dealt with the police. Now the Egyptians wanted to get in on the act. It would probably come down to a bribe in the end, she reassured herself. She sipped her drink, staring at Kamel. Finally, she said, "What do you want?" Kamel sat down, uninvited. "I am interested in your friend Alex Wolf." "He is not my friend." Kamel ignored that. "The British have told me two things about Mr. Wolf. One, that he knifed a soldier in Assyut. Two, that he tried to pass counterfeit English banknotes in a restaurant in Cairo. Already the story is a little curious. Why was he in Assyut? Why did he kill the soldier? And where did he get the forged money?" "I don't know anything about the man," said Sonia, hoping he would not come home right now. "I do, though," said Kamel. "I have other information that the British may or may not possess. I know who Alex Wolf is. His stepfather was a lawyer here in Cairo. His mother was German. I know, too, that Wolf is a nationalist. I know that he used to be your lover. And I know that you are a nationalist." Sonia had gone cold. She sat still, her drink untouched, watching the sly detective unreal the evidence against her. She said nothing. Kamel went on. "Where did he get the forged money?" "Not in Egypt. I don't think there is a printer in Egypt capable of doing the work. And if there were, I think he would make Egyptian currency. Therefore the money came from Europe. Now, Wolf, also known as Ahmed Ramha, quietly disappeared a couple of years ago." "Where did he go? Europe?" "He came back, via Assyut." "Why? Did he want to sneak into the country unnoticed? Perhaps he teamed up with an English counterfeiting gang and has now returned with his share of the profits. But I don't think so. For he is not a poor man, nor is he a criminal. So, there is a mystery." "He knows," Sonia thought. "Dear God, he knows. Now the British have asked me to put a watch on this houseboat and tell them of everyone who comes and goes here. Wolf will come here, they hope, and then they will arrest him, and then they will have the answers. Unless I solve the puzzle first. A watch on the boat. He could never come back. But why, she thought, is Kamel telling me? The key, I think, lies in Wolf's nature. He is both a German and an Egyptian. Kamel stood up and crossed the floor to sit beside Sonia and look into her face. I think he is fighting in this war. I think he is fighting for Germany and for Egypt. I think the forged money comes from the Germans. I think Wolf is a spy. Sonia thought, but you don't know where to find him. That's why you're here. Kamel was staring at her. She looked away, afraid that he might read her thoughts in her face. Kamel said, if he is a spy, I can catch him, or I can save him. Sonia jerked her head around to look at him. What does that mean? I want to meet him, secretly. But why? Kamel smiled his sly, knowing smile. Sonia, you are not the only one who wants Egypt to be free. There are many of us. We want to see the British defeated, and we are not fastidious about who does the defeating. We want to work with the Germans. We want to contact them. We want to talk to Rommel. And you think Ahmed can help you? If he is a spy, he must have a way of getting messages to the Germans. Sonia's mind was in a turmoil. From being her accuser, Kamel had turned into a co-conspirator, unless this was a trap. She did not know whether to trust him or not. She did not have enough time to think about it. She did not know what to say. So she said nothing. Kamel persisted gently. Can you arrange a meeting? She could not possibly make such a decision on the spur of the moment. No, she said. Remember the watch on the houseboat, he said. The surveillance reports will come to me before being passed on to Major Van Damme. If there is a chance, just a chance, that you might be able to arrange a meeting, I in turn can make sure that the reports which go to Van Damme are carefully edited so as to contain nothing embarrassing. Sonia had forgotten the surveillance. When Wolf came back, and he would sooner or later, the watchers would report it and Van Damme would know, unless Kamel fixed it. This changed everything. She had no choice. I'll arrange a meeting, she said. Good. He stood up. Call the main police station and leave a message saying that Sirhan wants to see me. When I get that message, I'll contact you to arrange date and time. Very well. He went to the ladder, then came back. By the way, he took a wallet from his trousers pocket and extracted a small photograph. He handed it to Sonia. It was a picture of her. Would you sign this for my wife? She's a great fan of yours. He handed her a pen. Her name is Hester. Sonia wrote, to Hester, with all good wishes, Sonia. She gave him the photograph, thinking, this is incredible. Thank you so much. She will be overjoyed. Incredible. Sonia said, I'll get in touch just as soon as I can. Thank you. He held out his hand. This time she took it. He went up the ladder and out, closing the hatch behind him. Sonia relaxed. Somehow she had handled it right. She was still not completely convinced of Kamel's sincerity, but if there was a trap, she could not see it. She felt tired. She finished the whiskey in the glass, then went through the curtains into the bedroom. She still had her nightdress on, and she was quite cold. She went to the bed and pulled back the covers. She heard a tapping sound. Her heart missed a beat. She whirled around to look at the porthole on the far side of the boat, the side that faced across the river. There was a head behind the glass. She screamed. The face disappeared. She realized it had been Wolf. She ran up the ladder and out onto the deck. Looking over the side, she saw him in the water. He appeared to be naked. He clambered up the side of the little boat, using the portholes for handholds. She reached for his arm and pulled him onto the deck. He knelt there on all fours for a moment, glancing up and down the riverbank like an alert water rat. Then he scampered down the hatch. She followed him. He stood on the carpet, dripping and shivering. He was naked. She said, "What happened?" "Run me a bath." he said. She went through the bedroom into the bathroom. There was a small tub with an electric water heater. She turned the taps on and threw a handful of scented crystals into the water. Wolf got in and let the water rise around him. "What happened?" Sonia repeated. He controlled his shivering.
"I didn't want to risk coming down the towpath, so I took off my clothes on the opposite bank and swam across. I looked in and saw that man with you. I suppose he was another policeman."
"Yes."
"So I had to wait in the water till he went away."
She laughed. "You poor thing."
"It's not funny. My God, I'm cold. The fucking Abwehr gave me dud money. Somebody will be strangled for that next time I'm in Germany."
"Why did they do it?"
"I don't know whether it's incompetence or disloyalty. Canaris has always been lukewarm on Hitler. Turn off the water, will you?"
He began to wash the river mud off his legs. "You'll have to use your own money," she said.
"I can't get at it. You can be sure the bank has instructions to call the police the moment I show my face. I could pay the occasional bill by check, but even that might help them get a line on me. I could sell some of my stocks and shares, or even the villa. But there again, the money has to come through a bank."
"So you will have to use my money," Sonia thought. "You won't ask, though. You'll just take it." She filed the thought for further consideration. "That detective is putting a watch on the boat, on Van Damme's instructions."
Wolf grinned. "So, it was Van Damme."
"Did you cut him?"
"Yes, but I wasn't sure where. It was dark."
"The face. He had a huge bandage."
Wolf laughed aloud. "I wish I could see him."
He became sober and asked,
"Did he question you?"
"Yes."
"What did you tell him?"
"That I hardly knew you."
"Good girl."
He looked at her appraisingly, and she knew that he was pleased, and a little surprised that she had kept her head. He said,
"Did he believe you?"
"Presumably not, since he ordered this surveillance."
Wolf frowned. "That's going to be awkward. I can't swim the river every time I want to come home."
"Don't worry," Sonia said. "I've fixed it."
"You fixed it?"
It was not quite so, Sonia knew, but it sounded good. "The detective is one of us," she explained.
"A nationalist?"
"Yes. He wants to use your radio."
"How does he know I've got one?"
There was a threatening note in Wolf's voice. "He doesn't," Sonia said calmly. "From what the British have told him, he deduces that you're a spy, and he presumes a spy has a means of communicating with the Germans. The nationalists want to send a message to Rommel."
Wolf shook his head. "I'd rather not get involved."
She would not have him go back on a bargain she had made. "You've got to get involved," she said sharply.
"I suppose I do," he said wearily.
She felt an odd sense of power. It was as if she were taking control. She found it exhilarating. Wolf said,
"They're closing in. I don't want any more surprises like last night. I'd like to leave this boat, but I don't know where to go. Abdullah knows my money's no good. He'd like to turn me over to the British. Damn."
"You'll be safe here while you string the detective along."
"I haven't any choice."
She sat on the edge of the bathtub, looking at his naked body. He seemed not defeated, but at least cornered. His face was lined with tension, and there was in his voice a faint note of panic. She guessed that for the first time he was wondering whether he could hold out until Rommel arrived. And also for the first time, he was dependent on her. He needed her money. He needed her home. Last night he had depended on her silence under interrogation, and, he now believed, he had been saved by her deal with the nationalist detective. He was slipping into her power. The thought intrigued her. She felt a little horny. Wolf said,
"I wonder if I should keep my date with that girl Elena tonight."
"Why not? She's nothing to do with the British. You picked her up in a shop."
"Maybe. I just feel it might be safer to lie low. I don't know."
"No," said Sonia firmly. "I want her." He looked up at her through narrowed eyes. She wondered whether he was considering the issue or thinking about her newfound strength of will.
"All right," he said finally. "I'll just have to take precautions."
He had given in. She had tested her strength against his, and she had won. It gave her a kind of thrill. She shivered.
"I'm still cold," Wolf said. Put some more hot water in.
No. Without removing her nightdress, Sonia got into the bath. She knelt astride him, facing him, her knees jammed against the sides of the narrow tub. She lifted the wet hem of the nightdress to the level of her waist. She said, "Eat me." He did.
Van Damme was in high spirits as he sat in the Oasis restaurant, sipping a cold martini with Jakes beside him. He had slept all day and had woken up feeling battered but ready to fight back. He had gone to the hospital, where Dr. Arbuthnot had told him he was a fool to be up and about, but a lucky fool, for his wound was mending. She had changed his dressing for a smaller, neater one that did not have to be secured by a yard of bandage around his head. Now it was 7:15, and in a few minutes he would catch Alex Wolfe. Van Damme and Jakes were at the back of the restaurant, in a position from which they could see the whole place. The table nearest to the entrance was occupied by two hefty sergeants eating fried chicken paid for by intelligence. Outside, in an unmarked car parked across the road, were two MPs in civilian clothes with their handguns in their jacket pockets. The trap was set. All that was missing was the bait. Elena would arrive at any minute. Billy had been shocked by the bandage at breakfast that morning. Van Damme had sworn the boy to secrecy, then told him the truth. "I had a fight with a German spy. He had a knife. He got away, but I think I may catch him tonight." It was a breach of security, but what the hell, the boy needed to know why his father was wounded. After hearing the story, Billy had not been worried anymore, but thrilled. Gaffar had been awestruck and inclined to move around softly and talk in whispers, as if there had been a death in the family. With Jakes, he found that last night's impulsive intimacy had left no overt trace. Their formal relationship had returned. Jakes took orders, called him sir, and did not offer opinions without being asked. It was just as well, Van Damme thought. They were a good team as things were, so why make changes? He looked at his wristwatch. It was 7:30. He lit another cigarette. At any moment now, Alex Wolfe would walk through the door. Van Damme felt sure he would recognize Wolfe, a tall, hawk-nosed European with brown hair and brown eyes, a strong, fit man. But he would make no move until Elena came in and sat by Wolfe. Then Van Damme and Jakes would move in. If Wolfe fled, the two sergeants would block the door, and in the unlikely event that he got past them, the MPs outside would shoot at him. 7:35. Van Damme was looking forward to interrogating Wolfe. What a battle of wills that would be. But Van Damme would win it, for he would have all the advantages. He would feel Wolfe out, find the weak points, and then apply pressure until the prisoner cracked. 7:39. Wolfe was late. Of course it was possible that he would not come at all. God forbid. Van Damme shuddered when he recalled how superciliously he had said to Bog, "I expect to arrest him tomorrow night." Van Damme's section was in very bad odor at the moment, and only the prompt arrest of Wolfe would enable them to come up smelling of roses. But suppose that, after last night's scare, Wolfe had decided to lie low for a while, wherever it was that he was lying. Somehow Van Damme felt that lying low was not Wolfe's style. He hoped not. At 7:40, the restaurant door opened, and Elena walked in. Van Damme heard Jake's whistle under his breath. She looked stunning. She wore a silk dress the color of clotted cream. Its simple lines drew attention to her slender figure, and its color and texture flattered her smooth, tan skin. Van Damme felt a sudden urge to stroke her. She looked around the restaurant, obviously searching for Wolfe and not finding him. Her eyes met Van Damme's and moved on without hesitating. The head waiter approached, and she spoke to him. He seated her at a table for two, close to the door. Van Damme caught the eye of one of the sergeants and inclined his head in Elena's direction. The sergeant gave a little nod of acknowledgement and checked his watch. Where was Wolfe? Van Damme lit a cigarette and began to worry. He had assumed that Wolfe, being a gentleman, would arrive a little early, and Elena would arrive a little late. According to that scenario, the arrest would have taken place the moment she sat down. It's going wrong, he thought. It's going bloody wrong. A waiter brought Elena a drink. It was 7:45. She looked in Van Damme's direction and gave a small, dainty shrug of her slight shoulders. The door of the restaurant opened. Van Damme froze with a cigarette halfway to his lips, then relaxed again, disappointed. It was only a small boy. The boy handed a piece of paper to a waiter, then went out again. Van Damme decided to order another drink. He saw the waiter go to Elena's table and hand her the piece of paper. Van Damme frowned. What was this? An apology from Wolf, saying he could not keep the date? Elena's face took on an expression of faint puzzlement. She looked at Van Damme and gave that little shrug again. Van Damme considered whether to go over and ask her what was going on, but that would have spoiled the ambush. For what if Wolf should walk in while Elena was talking to Van Damme? Wolf could turn around at the door and run, and he would have only the MPs to get past, two people instead of six. Van Damme murmured to Jakes, "Wait." Elena picked up her clutch bag from the chair beside her and stood up. She looked at Van Damme again, then turned around. Van Damme thought she was going to the ladies' room. Instead, she went to the door and opened it. Van Damme and Jakes got to their feet together. One of the sergeants half rose, looking at Van Damme, and Van Damme waved him down. No point in arresting Elena. Van Damme and Jakes hurried across the restaurant to the door. As they passed the sergeants, Van Damme said, "Follow me." They went through the door into the street. Van Damme looked around. There was a blind beggar sitting against the wall holding out a cracked dish with a few piastres in it. Three soldiers in uniform staggered along the pavement, already drunk, arms around each other's shoulders, singing a vulgar song. A group of Egyptians had met just outside the restaurant and were vigorously shaking hands. A street vendor offered Van Damme cheap razor blades. A few yards away, Elena was getting into a taxi. Van Damme broke into a run. The door of the taxi slammed, and it pulled away. Across the street, the MP's car roared, shot forward, and collided with a bus. Van Damme caught up with the taxi and leaped onto the running board. The car swerved suddenly. Van Damme lost his grip, hit the road running, and fell down. He got to his feet. His face blazed with pain. His wound was bleeding again, and he could feel the sticky warmth under the dressing. Jakes and the two sergeants gathered around him. Across the road, the MPs were arguing with the bus driver. The taxi had disappeared. Chapter 15. Elena was terrified. It had all gone wrong. Wolf was supposed to have been arrested in the restaurant, and now he was here, in a taxi with her, smiling a feral smile. She sat still, her mind a blank. "Who was he?" Wolf said, still smiling. Elena could not think. She looked at Wolf, looked away again, and said, "What?" "That man who ran after us. He jumped on the running board. I couldn't see him properly, but I thought he was a European. Who was he?" Elena fought down her fear. "He's William Van Damme, and he was supposed to arrest you." She had to make up a story. Why would someone follow her out of a restaurant and try to get into her taxi? I don't know him. He was in the restaurant." Suddenly she was inspired. "He was bothering me. I was alone. It's your fault you were late." "I'm so sorry," he said quickly. "And why are we in a taxi?" she demanded. "What's it all about? Why aren't we having dinner?" She heard a whining note in her voice and hated it. "I had a wonderful idea." He smiled again, and Elena suppressed a shudder. "We're going to have a picnic. There's a basket in the trunk." She did not know whether to believe him. Why had he pulled that stunt at the restaurant, sending a boy in with the message, "Come outside, A.W., unless he suspected a trap? What would he do now? Take her into the desert and knife her? She had a sudden urge to leap out of the speeding car. She closed her eyes and forced herself to think calmly. If he suspected a trap, why did he come at all? No, it had to be more complex than that. He seemed to have believed her about the man on the running board, but she could not be sure what was going on behind his smile. She said, "Where are we going?" "A few miles out of town, to a little spot on the river bank where we can watch the sun go down. It's going to be a lovely evening." "I don't want to go." What's the matter? I hardly know you.
Don't be silly. The driver will be with us all the time, and I'm a gentleman. I should get out of the car.
Please don't. He touched her arm lightly. I have some smoked salmon and a cold chicken and a bottle of champagne. I get so bored with restaurants.
Elena considered. She could leave him now, and she would be safe. She would never see him again. That was what she wanted, to get away from the man forever. She thought, but I'm Van Damme's only hope. What do I care for Van Damme? I'd be happy never to see him again and go back to the old peaceful life. The old life. She did care for Van Damme, she realized. At least enough for her to hate the thought of letting him down. She had to stay with Wolf, cultivate him, angle for another date, try to find out where he lived. Impulsively, she said, "Let's go to your place." He raised his eyebrows.
"That's a sudden change of heart."
She realized she had made a mistake. "I'm confused," she said. "You sprung a surprise on me. Why didn't you ask me first?"
"I only thought of the idea an hour ago. It didn't occur to me that it might scare you."
Elena realized that she was, unintentionally, fulfilling her role as a dizzy girl. She decided not to overplay her hand. "All right," she said. She tried to relax. Wolf was studying her. He said, "You're not quite as vulnerable as you seem, are you?"
"I don't know. I remember what you said to Aristopoulos that first day I saw you in the shop."
Elena remembered. She had threatened to cut off Mickey's cock if he touched her again. She should have blushed, but she could not do so voluntarily. "I was so angry," she said.
Wolf chuckled. "You sounded it," he said. "Try to bear in mind that I am not Aristopoulos."
She gave him a weak smile. "Okay." He turned his attention to the driver. They were out of the city, and Wolf began to give directions. Elena wondered where he had found this taxi. By Egyptian standards, it was luxurious. It was some kind of American car, with big soft seats and lots of room, and it seemed only a few years old. They passed through a series of villages, then turned onto an unmade road. The car followed the winding track up a small hill and emerged on a little plateau atop a bluff. The river was immediately below them, and on its far side Elena could see the neat patchwork of cultivated fields stretching into the distance until they met the sharp, tan-colored line at the edge of the desert. Wolf said, "Isn't this a lovely spot?" Elena had to agree. A flight of swifts rising from the far bank of the river drew her eye upward, and she saw that the evening clouds were already edged in pink. A young girl was walking away from the river with a huge water jug on her head. A lone felucca sailed upstream, propelled by a light breeze. The driver got out of the car and walked 50 yards away. He sat down, pointedly turning his back on them, lit a cigarette, and unfolded a newspaper. Wolf got a picnic hamper out of the trunk and set it on the floor of the car between them. As he began to unpack the food, Elena asked him, "How did you discover this place?"
"My mother brought me here when I was a boy." He handed her a glass of wine. "And after my father died, my mother married an Egyptian. From time to time, she would find the Muslim household oppressive, so she would bring me here in a gharry and tell me about Europe and so on."
"Did you enjoy it?" He hesitated.
"My mother had a way of spoiling things like that. She was always interrupting the fun. She used to say, 'You're so selfish, just like your father.' At that age, I preferred my Arab family. My stepbrothers were wicked, and nobody tried to control them. We used to steal oranges from other people's gardens, throw stones at horses to make them bolt, puncture bicycle tires. Only my mother minded, and all she could do was warn us that we'd get punished eventually. She was always saying that, 'They'll catch you one day, Alex.'"
The mother was right, Elena thought. They would catch Alex one day. She was relaxing. She wondered whether Wolf was carrying the knife he had used in Asyut, and that made her tense again. The situation was so normal, a charming man taking a girl on a picnic beside the river, that for a moment she had forgotten she wanted something from him. She said, "Where do you live now?"
My house has been commandeered by the British. I'm living with friends.
He handed her a slice of smoked salmon on a china plate, then sliced a lemon in half with a kitchen knife. Elena watched his deft hands. She wondered what he wanted from her, that he should work so hard to please her. Van Damme felt very low. His face hurt, and so did his pride. The great arrest had been a fiasco. He had failed professionally. He had been outwitted by Alex Wolfe, and he had sent Elena into danger. He sat at home, his cheek newly bandaged, drinking gin to ease the pain. Wolfe had evaded him so damn easily. Van Damme was sure the spy had not really known about the ambush, otherwise he would not have turned up at all. No, he had just been taking precautions, and the precautions had worked beautifully. They had a good description of the taxi. It had been a distinctive car, quite new, and Jakes had read the number plate. Every policeman and MP in the city was looking out for it, and had orders to stop it on sight and arrest all the occupants. They would find it, sooner or later, and Van Damme felt sure it would be too late. Nevertheless, he was sitting by the phone. What was Elena doing now? Perhaps she was in a candlelit restaurant drinking wine and laughing at Wolfe's jokes. Van Damme pictured her in the cream-colored dress, holding a glass, smiling her special impish smile, the one that promised you anything you wanted. Van Damme checked his watch. Perhaps they had finished dinner by now. What would they do then? It was traditional to go and look at the pyramids by moonlight. The black sky, the stars, the endless flat desert, and the clean triangular plains of the pharaoh's tombs. The area would be deserted, except perhaps for another pair of lovers. They might climb a few levels, he springing up ahead and then reaching down to lift her. But soon she would be exhausted, her hair and her dress a little awry, and she would say that these shoes were not designed for mountaineering. So they would sit on the great stones, still warm from the sun, and breathe the mild night air while they watched the stars. Walking back to the taxi, she would shiver in her sleeveless evening gown, and he might put an arm around her shoulders to keep her warm. Would he kiss her in the taxi? No, he was too old for that. When he made his pass, it would be in some sophisticated manner. Would he suggest going back to his place or hers? Van Damme did not know which to hope for. If they went to his place, Elena would report in the morning, and Van Damme would be able to arrest Wolfe at home with his radio, his code book, and perhaps even his back traffic. Professionally, that would be better. But it would also mean that Elena would spend a night with Wolfe, and that thought made Van Damme more angry than it should have done. Alternatively, if they went to her place, where Jakes was waiting with 10 men and 3 cars, Wolfe would be grabbed before he got a chance to... Van Damme got up and paced the room. Idly, he picked up the book Rebecca, the one he thought Wolfe was using as the basis of his code. He read the first line. Last night, I dreamt I went to Manderley again. He put the book down, then opened it again and read on. The story of the vulnerable, bullied girl was a welcome distraction from his own worries. When he realized that the girl would marry the glamorous older widower, and that the marriage would be blighted by the ghostly presence of the man's first wife, he closed the book and put it down again. What was the age difference between himself and Elena? How long would he be haunted by Angela? She, too, had been coldly perfect. Elena, too, was young, impulsive, and in need of rescue from the life she was living. These thoughts irritated him, for he was not going to marry Elena. He lit a cigarette. Why did the time pass so slowly? Why did the phone not ring? How could he have let Wolfe slip through his fingers twice in 2 days? Where was Elena? Where was Elena? He had sent a woman into danger once before. It had happened after his other great fiasco, when Rashid Ali had slipped out of Turkey under Van Damme's nose. Van Damme had sent a woman agent to pick up the German agent, the man who had changed clothes with Ali and enabled him to escape. He had hoped to salvage something from the shambles by finding out all about the man. But next day, the woman had been found dead in a hotel bed.
It was a chilling parallel. There was no point in staying in the house. He could not possibly sleep, and there was nothing else he could do there. He would go and join Jakes and the others, despite Dr. Arbuthnot's orders. He put on a coat and his uniform cap, went outside, and wheeled his motorcycle out of the garage.
This ends side two of cassette five of The Key to Rebecca. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette six. Becca, cassette six.
Elena and Wolf stood together, close to the edge of the bluff, looking at the distant lights of Cairo and the nearer flickering glimmers of peasant fires in dark villages. Elena was thinking of an imaginary peasant, hard-working, poverty-stricken, superstitious, laying a straw mattress on the earth floor, pulling a rough blanket around him, and finding consolation in the arms of his wife. Elena had left poverty behind, she hoped forever. But sometimes it seemed to her that she had left something else behind with it, something she could not do without. In Alexandria, when she was a child, people would put blue palm prints on the red mud walls, hand shapes, to ward off evil. Elena did not believe in the efficacy of the palm prints. But despite the rats, despite the nightly screams as the moneylender beat both of his wives, despite the ticks that infested everyone, despite the early death of many babies, she believed there had been something there that warded off evil. She had been looking for that something when she took men home, took them into her bed, accepted their gifts and their caresses and their money, but she had never found it. She did not want to do that anymore. She had spent too much of her life looking for love in the wrong places. In particular, she did not want to do it with Alex Wolf. Several times she had said to herself, why not do it just once more? That was Van Damme's coldly reasonable point of view. But each time she contemplated making love with Wolf, she saw again the daydream that had plagued her for the last few weeks, the daydream of seducing William Van Damme. She knew just how Van Damme would be. He would look at her with innocent wonder and touch her with wide-eyed delight. Thinking of it, she felt momentarily helpless with desire. She knew how Wolf would be, too. He would be knowing, selfish, skillful, and unshockable. Without speaking, she turned from the view and walked back toward the car. It was time for him to make his pass. They had finished the meal, emptied the champagne bottle and the flask of coffee, picked clean the chicken and the bunch of grapes. Now he would expect his just reward. From the back seat of the car, she watched him. He stayed a moment longer on the edge of the bluff, then walked toward her, calling to the driver. He had the confident grace that height often seemed to give to men. He was an attractive man, much more glamorous than any of Elena's lovers had been. But she was afraid of him, and her fear came not just from what she knew about him, his history and his secrets and his knife, but from an intuitive understanding of his nature. Somehow she knew that his charm was not spontaneous, but manipulative, and that if he was kind, it was because he wanted to use her. She had been used enough. Wolf got in beside her. Did you enjoy the picnic? She made an effort to be bright. Yes, it was lovely. Thank you. The car pulled away. Either he would invite her to his place, or he would take her to her flat and ask for a nightcap. She would have to find an encouraging way to refuse him.
This struck her as ridiculous. She was behaving like a frightened virgin. She thought, what am I doing? Saving myself for Mr. Wright? She had been silent for too long. She was supposed to be witty and engaging. She should talk to him. Have you heard the war news? She asked, and realized at once it was not the most light-hearted of topics. The Germans are still winning, he said. Of course. Why, of course? He smiled condescendingly at her. The world is divided into masters and slaves, Elena. He spoke as if he were explaining simple facts to a schoolboy. The British have been masters too long. They've gone soft. And now it will be someone else's turn. And the Egyptians? Are they masters or slaves? She knew she should shut up. She was walking on thin ice. But his complacency infuriated her. The Bedouin are masters, he said. But the average Egyptian is a born slave. She thought, he means every word of it. She shuddered. They reached the outskirts of the city. It was after midnight and the suburbs were quiet, although downtown would still be buzzing. Wolf said, where do you live? She told him. So it was to be her place. Wolf said, we must do this again. They reached the Sharia Abbas, and he told the driver to stop. Elena wondered what was going to happen now. Wolf turned to her and said, thank you for a lovely evening. I'll see you soon. He got out of the car. She stared in astonishment. He bent down by the driver's window, gave the man some money, and told him Elena's address. The driver nodded. Wolf banged on the roof of the car, and the driver pulled away. Elena looked back and saw Wolf waving. As the car began to turn a corner, Wolf started walking toward the river. She thought, what do you make of that? No pass? No invitation to his place? No nightcap? Not even a good night kiss? What game was he playing? Hard to get? She puzzled over the whole thing as the taxi took her home. Perhaps it was Wolf's technique to try to intrigue a woman. Perhaps he was just eccentric. Whatever the reason, she was very grateful. She sat back and relaxed. She was not obliged to choose between fighting him off and going to bed with him. Thank God. The taxi drew up outside her building. Suddenly, from nowhere, three cars roared up. One stopped right in front of the taxi, one close behind, and one alongside. Men materialized out of the shadows. All four doors of the taxi were flung open, and four guns pointed in. Elena screamed. Then a head was poked into the car, and Elena recognized Van Damme. Gone? Van Damme said. Elena realized what was happening. I thought you were going to shoot me, she said. Where did you leave him? Sharia Abbas. How long ago? 5 or 10 minutes. May I get out of the car? He gave her a hand and she stepped onto the pavement. He said, I'm sorry we scared you. This is called slamming the stable door after the horse has bolted. Quite. He looked utterly defeated. She felt a surge of affection for him. She touched his arm. You've no idea how happy I am to see your face, she said. He gave her an odd look, as if he was not sure whether to believe her. She said, why don't you send your men home and come and talk inside? He hesitated. All right. He turned to one of his men, a captain. Jakes, I want you to interrogate the taxi driver. See what you can get out of him. Let the men go. I'll see you at GHQ in an hour or so. Very good, sir. Elena led the way inside. It was so good to enter her own apartment, slump on the sofa, and kick off her shoes. The trial was over. Wolf had gone, and Van Damme was here. She said, help yourself to a drink. No thanks. What went wrong, anyway? Van Damme sat down opposite her and took out his cigarettes. We expected him to walk into the trap all unawares, but he was suspicious, or at least cautious, and we missed him. What happened then? She rested her head against the back of the sofa, closed her eyes, and told him in a few words about the picnic. She left out her thoughts about going to bed with Wolf, and she did not tell Van Damme that Wolf had hardly touched her all evening. She spoke abruptly. She wanted to forget, not remember. When she had told him the story, she said, "Make me a drink, even if you won't have one." He went to the cupboard. Elena could see that he was angry. She looked at the bandage on his face. She had seen it in the restaurant and again a few minutes ago when she arrived, but now she had time to wonder what it was. She said, "What happened to your face?"
"We almost caught Wolf last night."
"Oh, no." So he had failed twice in 24 hours. No wonder he looked defeated. She wanted to console him, to put her arms around him, to lay his head in her lap and stroke his hair. The longing was like an ache. She decided impulsively, the way she always decided things, that she would take him to her bed tonight. He gave her a drink. He had made one for himself, after all. As he stooped to hand her the glass, she reached up, touched his chin with her fingertips, and turned his head so that she could look at his cheek. He let her look, just for a second, then moved his head away. She had not seen him as tense as this before. He crossed the room and sat opposite her, holding himself upright on the edge of the chair. He was full of a suppressed emotion, something like rage, but when she looked into his eyes, she saw not anger, but pain. He said, "How did Wolf strike you?" She was not sure what he was getting at. "Charming? Intelligent? Dangerous?" "His appearance?" "Clean hands, a silk shirt, a mustache that doesn't suit him. What are you fishing for?" He shook his head irritably. "Nothing. Everything." He lit another cigarette. She could not reach him in this mood. She wanted him to come and sit beside her and tell her she was beautiful and brave and she had done well. But she knew it was no use asking. All the same, she said, "How did I do?"
"I don't know," he said. "What did you do?"
"You know what I did."
"Yes. I'm most grateful."
He smiled, and she knew the smile was insincere. What was the matter with him? There was something familiar in his anger, something she would understand as soon as she put her finger on it. It was not just that he felt he had failed. It was his attitude to her, the way he spoke to her, the way he sat across from her, and especially the way he looked at her. His expression was one of... it was almost one of disgust.
"He said he would see you again?" Van Damme asked.
"Yes."
"I hope he does."
He put his chin in his hands. His face was strained with tension. Wisps of smoke rose from his cigarette. "Christ, I hope he does." "He also said, 'We must do this again,' or something like that," Elena told him.
"I see. We must do this again, huh?"
"Something like that."
"What do you think he had in mind, exactly?"
She shrugged. "Another picnic? Another date?" "Damn it, William, what has got into you?"
"I'm just curious," he said.
His face wore a twisted grin, one she had never seen on him before. "I'd like to know what the two of you did other than eat and drink in the back of that big taxi and on the riverbank. You know, all that time together in the dark, a man and a woman." "Shut up." She closed her eyes. Now she understood. Now she knew. Without opening her eyes, she said, "I'm going to bed. You can see yourself out." A few seconds later, the front door slammed. She went to the window and looked down to the street. She saw him leave the building and get on his motorcycle. He kicked the engine into life and roared off down the road at a breakneck speed and took the corner at the end as if he were in a race. Elena was very tired and a little sad that she would be spending the night alone after all. But she was not unhappy, for she had understood his anger. She knew the cause of it, and that gave her hope. As he disappeared from sight, she smiled faintly and said softly, "William Van Damme, I do believe you're jealous." Chapter 16. By the time Major Smith made his third lunchtime visit to the houseboat, Wolf and Sonia had gotten into a slick routine. Wolf hid in the cupboard when the Major approached. Sonia met him in the living room with a drink in her hand ready for him. She made him sit down there, ensuring that his briefcase was put down before they went into the bedroom. After a minute or two, she began kissing him.
By this time, she could do what she liked with him, for he was paralyzed by lust. She contrived to get his shorts off, then soon afterward took him into the bedroom. It was clear to Wolf that nothing like this had ever happened to the Major before. He was Sonia's slave as long as she allowed him to make love to her. Wolf was grateful. Things would not have been quite so easy with a more strong-minded man. As soon as Wolf heard the bed creak, he came out of the cupboard. He took the key out of the shorts pocket and opened the case. His notebook and pencil were beside him, ready. Smith's second visit had been disappointing, leading Wolf to wonder whether perhaps it was only occasionally that Smith saw battle plans. However, this time he struck gold again. General Sir Claude Auchinleck, the CNC in Middle East, had taken over direct control of the 8th Army from General Neil Ritchie. As a sign of Allied panic, that alone would be welcome news to Rommel. It might also help Wolf, for it meant that battles were now being planned in Cairo rather than in the desert, in which case Smith was more likely to get copies. The Allies had retreated to a new defense line at Mersa Matruh, and the most important paper in Smith's briefcase was a summary of the new dispositions. The new line began at the coastal village of Matruh and stretched south into the desert, as far as an escarpment called Sidi Hamza. 10th Corps was at Matruh. Then there was a heavy minefield 15 miles long. Then a lighter minefield for 10 miles. Then the escarpment. Then, south of the escarpment, the 13th Corps. With half an ear on the noises from the bedroom, Wolf considered the position. The picture was fairly clear. The Allied line was strong at either end and weak in the middle. Rommel's likeliest move, according to Allied thinking, was a dash around the southern end of the line, a classic Rommel outflanking maneuver, made more feasible by his capture of an estimated 500 tons of fuel at Tobruk. Such an advance would be repelled by the 13th Corps, which consisted of the strong 1st Armored Division and the 2nd New Zealand Division. The latter, the summary noted helpfully, freshly arrived from Syria. However, armed with Wolf's information, Rommel could instead hit the soft center of the line and pull